that I have done in collaboration with Alejandro Corichi and Jerónimo Cortez from Mexico, and with Evelino from Portugal. So next slide. The outline of the talk is that we'll start with a motivation of why I consider that it's important to study in homogeneous quantum cosmology. And then I will focus on the model that I will present in more in detail here. There is a Gaudi T3 model. In that case, I will comment briefly on the standard quantization that was introduced by Monica Pierri and the problems of unitarity that this quantization has. And then I will present a new field parametrization for the metric of this model that we have introduced and that solves the problems with unitarity. This is a part of our work that I assume that Alejandro Corichi will explain in more detail in his seminar in a couple of weeks from now. So instead of presenting in detail that quantization, I will continue and present here a proof of the uniqueness of the FOC quantization that we have carried out of the model. And then I will conclude with some remarks and the discussion of our results. So next slide, please. Okay, we are now living in a time in which the astrophysical data have given rise to what we call the dawn of precision cosmology. Even more this year, the Nobel Prize has been given to two researchers that have detected the cosmic microwave background, and in particular, the anisotropies that have their origin in the inhomogeneities that were present at the time of the coupling. The analysis of these anisotropies calls for the development of inhomogeneous cosmology. The way in which this analysis is carried out classically is by perturbative methods. But from the point of view of quantum cosmology, we are not very sure, we cannot trust very much on this kind of perturbative formalisms. What would be desirable is first to carry out the quantization of cosmological models with local degrees of freedom, and in those models try to find and understand what is a semi-classical regime, and from this regime deduce effective theories that can be treated in a perturbative way. Another reason for studying inhomogeneous space-time is to try to extend the analysis and the result of loop quantum cosmology that have been so successful in homogeneous settings. In this case, one would obviously like to deduce the results from the full theory of loop quantum gravity, but since this is too ambitious, an intermediate step would be to try at least to quantize by this kind of loop approaches models that have local degrees of freedom. In this way, one would validate the results of homogeneous loop quantum cosmology and also get new predictions. One of the problems is that so far we don't have any true inhomogeneous cosmological model that we can consider has been fully quantized, not just by the loop approach, but even with more standard quantum field theoretical methods. Having these kinds of cosmological models will be very helpful for comparison of techniques and of the physical interpretations in cosmology. Probably the model that is closer to this situation is a linearly polarized Gaudi model with the topology of the three torus. And this is precisely why we decided to study this model. Furthermore, the interest in this cosmological model is also from different perspectives, as can be seen from the viewpoint of quantum field theory in curved backgrounds and also from parameterized field theory. The reason essentially is that the Golden Model has a reformulation in terms of a massless scalar field coupled to gravity in less dimension, in this case in 2 plus 1 dimension, but still with some symmetries that are remnant, in this case axial symmetry. So this is like a limiting case, for instance, for parametrized field theory, in which one knows that changes between Cauchy surfaces can be described by unitary evolution in the case of two space-time dimensions. But for higher dimensions, the result is that in general, unitarity is lost. In our case, we have more than two dimensions, but we have still symmetries that can be used to have, in fact, an effective dimensional reduction. Finally, the Golden Model is non-stationary, and of course, it has an infinite number of degrees of freedom. And due to these reasons, the problems of unitarity of the dynamical evolution and the problem of the uniqueness of the quantization, in this case by means of Fock representation, are relevant, are important in the quantum analysis of the system. In models with a finite number of degrees of freedom, essentially all the quantizations can be considered unitarily equivalent. However, when we have local degrees of freedom, we know that different possibilities are available in the quantization that are not unitarily equivalent. Okay, next slide, please. So I will now briefly describe what is a Golden model with the topology of the three torus. This model describes families of spacetimes in vacuo with no matter fields, whose spatial topology is compact, in this case is the topology of three torus, and which have two commuting or Killing vector fields. For this model, the Killing vector fields are axial and they are hypersurface orthogonal. This means essentially that the metric can be written in a diagonal form. The classical solutions are inhomogeneous spacetime, and they start with an initial cosmological singularity, or in the 10 reversal version of the system, they end a big crunch. The metric, after a gauge fixing procedure, can be written in the following form, in which we see essentially two blocks. One corresponds to the orbits of the isometries, and is described with two coordinates, sigma and delta, such that all the metric fields are independent of them. The different weight of the two diagonal elements corresponding to this part of the metric is described by a field, phi, that in this case will be the only local degrees of freedom of the system after reduction. The other part of the metric contains the dependence on the time, which is taken as a positive coordinate t, and of a coordinate, angular coordinate, defined on the circle, theta. It is written in a conformally flat way with a conformal factor that essentially is described by a function gamma, and then one can fix the angular diffeomorphism corresponding to the coordinate theta by demanding that the momentum of gamma has vanishing non-zero modes. In this way, one also gets essentially the way or the form of the function gamma is set for its zero mode that has still a freedom in a homogeneous variable. There is this capital Q. Capital Q and this capital P that is related to the homogeneous part of the momentum P gamma are, as I said, homogeneous variables are canonically conjugate. The Hamiltonian constraint, the gauge degree of freedom associated to E, can be fixed by demanding by introducing the parametrization that takes into account that the determinant of the metric induced in the healing orbit is known to have a time-like gradient. So what we do is to take the square root of this determinant and to make it equal to a time coordinate except for a factor of this lowercase p. In this way, we get a almost completely fixed gauge, and we see that the metric is described just by these homogeneous degrees of freedom, Q and P, and by the field phi that depends on the coordinates P and theta. There is some arbitrariness in our description in our gauge fixing. First, this, of course, the choice of the time, the parametrization. In a certain sense, it is natural, because I have said already that it is known that the determinant of the metric on the isometric orbit is a time-like gradient. So, in a certain sense, it's a natural choice of time that is available in the system. I will anyway comment on this issue at the end of the talk. There's also arbitrariness in the choice of the field phi. We could choose any other function of phi of the time t and of the homogeneous variables q and p to describe our metric. And in a certain sense, this is what we will use later to solve the problems with unitarity in our system. Okay, next slide.
So, Guillermo, so the field phi...
Yes, sure.
If field phi depends on only two coordinates, right? Only on T and...
Yes, only on T and theta.
Okay.
Okay, so I continue. In the gauge fixing, I said it was almost complete, and this is because there is still some global constraint left, which is this T naught, and that it generates the group of constant translations on the circle. That's why we had some homogeneous degrees of freedom remnant in the system. Notice also that the homogeneous constraint only affects the field sector of the system. The reduced model has then these homogeneous variables, Q and P, that correspond essentially to a point particle, and then we have the field-like degrees of freedom described by the field phi and its momentum. I will focus just on this field part of the phase space. The Hamiltonian, or the field, is time-dependent, and it gives rise to an equation of motion that is essentially a Klein-Gordon equation for a massless scalar field propagating in a 2 plus 1 background that is time-dependent, it's not static. Next slide. The background is essentially expanding, it has the compact sections that are expanding to torus. It is possible to find the solutions for this wave equation, and they are written there in terms of a basis of functions Fn. They are given by linear combinations with constants An and their complex conjugate, A star n, and the functions Fn are given by the Fourier mode, the exponential of In theta, and then except for the zero mode, the time-dependent part is just the third order Hankel function of the second kind with an argument equal to the wave number, the absolute value of n, multiplied by t, the time coordinate. This choice of basis of set of solutions is such that they are orthonormal with the product that provides the simplicity structure of the model. Essentially, this means that the constants An and their complex conjugate have question brackets there are those of annihilation-like and creation-like variables. The simplicity structure that appears there, this tilde omega of S, is defined on any constant time section. It's independent of the section chosen. I want to notice that there is a factor of T in that expression that will play an important role in our argument. Smooth solutions have coefficients An that decrease faster than the inverse of any polynomial in N. This set of a smooth solution with this simplicity structure will be the covariant phase, the space of the system. Next slide. Instead of working in the covariant phase space, I will make most of my discussion in the canonical phase space. The passage from one to the other can be easily done once a certain Cauchy surface is given. And for the Cauchy surface, I will just take a section of constant time, T equal to T naught. The isomorphism between the canonical and the covariant phase space essentially corresponds to taking initial values for the field and its derivative. So given a solution, I can find the value of the field and its momentum just by evaluating at the given Cauchy surface. And oppositely, if I have these initial values, I can construct the smooth solution. Then I can also define an evolution in the canonical phase space just by considering two different Cauchy surfaces and then composing the isomorphisms that these two surfaces provide. I will call V the essentially the classical evolution operator on the canonical phase space that I obtained this way. Now, from now on, I will just consider a given Cauchy surface and use this isomorphism to define all the structure on canonical phase space. This point in which there has been some confusion, I will try now to shed some light on it, is the use of certain variables essentially to describe the phase space. It's just like a choice of coordinates to describe it. I can, instead of taking the field and its momentum, I can just take first their Fourier coefficients, since they are defined on the circle, and then I can also take linear combination of these Fourier coefficients. So in this way, I can define, as it appears there, this A of T1 N coefficients. And the thing I want to remark is that their expression depends explicitly on the time T1 that I use for the linear combination. If I make T1 equal to T naught, the Cauchy surface that I am considering, then these coefficients coincide with the constant of motion An. They are constant of motion only in the following sense. If I consider simultaneously their implicit and explicit time dependence, this means that I will have to consider the evolution of phase space given by B, and then also the evolution that is given by Hund due to the explicit time dependence. I can change from one value of T, let's say T naught, to another one, T1, in this expression. If I freeze this explicit dependence, then I will get just some coordinates for my canonical phase space in the, associated to the Cauchy surface that I am considering. So this what has done in order to attain, quantization of the system. For this, in order to introduce a for quantization, what one has to do essentially is to define a calorization of our symplectic vector space. And in order to do that, one has to give a complex structure. This complex structure, I remember, a complex structure is a real linear map whose square is equal to minus the identity. And in order to give an inner product, a well-defined inner product, it has to be compatible with the protective structure. This means they have to preserve it, and it has to give a positive definite metric when it is composed with the symplectic structure, in the sense that the complex structure acts in one of the arguments, and then the symplectic structure gives us the positive definite metric. The complex structure that was introduced to quantize the system is what I have called here G tilde naught, and essentially corresponds to identifying the coordinate an at t naught as the annihilation-like variables and their complex conjugates as creation-like variables. So with this complex structure, one can define the positive frequency sector and then complete it with the inner product in order to obtain a one particle Hilbert space H tilde naught. Next slide. Then just by taking tensor products and symmetrices, then one obtains by the standard method the symmetric Fox space based on that Hilbert space H tilde naught. If one wants the physical Hilbert space, then one has to impose the only constraint that was remaining in the system, T naught. This is essentially the way that was followed to obtain a quantization of the Golgi model by Monica Pierre. Okay, I think that I can stop here and see whether you have any questions before following. Okay, if there is no question, I will follow. So it was soon realized that in that quantization, that the standard quantization, there were problems with the unitarity of the dynamical evolution, in the sense that it was the evolution of the system could not be implemented as a unitary transformation. Let me first give some results that are more or less standard about unitary implementation of symplectic transformations. I will call a general symplectic transformation B. One particular case is exactly the one that is given by the evolution of the system in our case. And then this B will induce from the symplectic structure G tilde naught a new symplectic structure G tilde V. Then it is known that V can be implemented unitarily on the Fock space based on the Hilbert space obtained with the complex structure G tilde naught if and only if the difference between these two complex structures, G tilde phi and G tilde naught, is Hilbert-Schmidt. This, in turn, is equivalent to another condition that appears, for instance, in the works by Astegar, in which this difference of complex structure is divided by their sum. In turn, this is equivalent to say that the two complex structures provide Fock representations that are unitarily equivalent. And finally, all these results are equivalent to saying that the antilinear part of V obtained with the complex structure G tilde naught is Hilbert-Schmidt. In the case that the symplectic transformation is described using annihilation-like and creation-like variables, one obtains what is usually called a Bogoliubov transformation. In this case, the condition of it being Hilbert-Schmidt is just that the so-called beta coefficients are such that the square of their absolute values have a finite trace. In the case of the Golgi model, the linearly polarized Golgi model, one can easily see that the beta coefficients have only one contribution for each mode. There's only one non-vanishing beta coefficient. And these coefficients can easily be computed using the orthonormalization of our basis of solutions, Fn. Next slide, slide 9. So one gets exactly the expression that appears in this slide in terms of the Henkel functions of the first and the, sorry, of zeroth and first order. Using their asymptotic expansions, then one see that essentially a solute value of beta does not tend to zero for large wave numbers, and therefore they cannot be square summable. So this means that the evolution that we are considering, given by this classical operator P, cannot be implemented unitarily in the off quantization determined by our complex structure G tilde naught. In fact, Torre also showed that this negative result was also true not just for the Fock space obtained for the system without the global constraint, but it also persisted when the constraint was imposed and one reduced all consideration to the physical field space. From the expression of beta, one can see that the fact that is that not tend to zero for large n is due to the appearance of these factors of T in the first identity in the slide. And these factors come in fact from the factor of T that is present in the symplectic structure of the system. Since this structure is a bilinear form, then intuitively one could think of solving the problem by absorbing a factor of a square root of T in each of the fields. So essentially scaling the field by a factor given by the square root of T. Next slide. That this trick may work can also be seen from the following viewpoint. If one considers our basis of solutions, the solutions Fn, then for large weight numbers, one sees that they behave just like the standard modes of a free massless scalar field, propagating in this case in a Minkowski background in two dimensions, because there is no dependence in the third coordinate that would correspond to an angular coordinate. As I was saying, the asymptotic behavior will be that of a standard modes. Why not? Because of a factor of a square root of T that is dividing the expression. So the solutions for the scale field by the square root of T would have exactly an asymptotic behavior that would correspond to a standard modes. And since for the free massless case in a Minkowski background, we know that there are no problems with unitarity, we hope that the same will happen here after performing this scaling. So this is essentially what we did. We scaled the field and then completed the transformation so that it became canonical on phase to phase, dividing the momentum just by the same factor. That this is something reasonable in our model is clear from the point from the fact that we had already fixed the 10 gauge and that all the structures in our system were 10 dependent. So there's no reason why one should forbid performing canonical transformations that depend explicitly on 10. But when one does this kind of transformation, then what one is really doing is changing the dynamics of the system. In our case, you see the expression of our new field, chi, then if this is the fundamental field, what we are doing is splitting the time dependence of phi in an intrinsic one that dictates the evolution of chi and an explicit extrinsic one that is given just by this factor of square root of t. This last explicit dependence is not, its evolution is not generated by any Hamiltonian. So the dynamics of the two fields is different. Next slide, please. This is standard in mechanics. We know that when we have a canonical transformation depending on time, then the new Hamiltonian is given by the old one, but corrected by the derivative of the generating functional with respect to its explicit time dependence. When you do this in our system, you obtain a new Hamiltonian. This does correspond, in fact, to a free massless field in two dimensions. And then from the explicit time dependence of our canonical transformation, you get an extra term. It's a cross term between the field chi and its momentum. Notice also that this is time dependent and that tends to zero asymptotically for large time. Okay, so if one wanted to describe this new system, what one can do is just to expand the field chi and its momentum in Fourier series, taking the Fourier coefficients as the new variables on phase space, they form canonical pairs, and then one can also get from them just linear combinations corresponding to annihilation-like and creation-like variables. In order not to introduce any explicit time dependence, then one can just take the linear combination that would correspond to a massless scalar field. Okay? And this is just expression of these variables an that appear there. I will comment a little bit more about this kind of choice later. So if this were our choice essentially of annihilation-like variables with the creation-like variables given by the complex conjugates, then the problem is that one can show that when they are promoted to operators, the vacuum obtained for the system for quantization is such that it does not belong to the domain of the Hamiltonian. This means essentially nothing for the unitarity of the evolution, but let's say there is something that is not desirable. Even more, if one wants to calculate a matrix element in vacuum for powers of the Hamiltonian, like for instance in a series expansion. So in order to cure this problem and to have a quantization with better properties, what we did is the following. So please, next slide. Since the problem comes just from this cross term between the field chi and its momentum, the thing that one usually does is just form a perfect square absorbing this cross term. This leads you to a new time-dependent canonical transformation in which the field has exactly the same scaling as before, but the momentum gets a contribution that is linear in the field. So is there any comment before I continue? Any question?
This is still a canonical transformation, right?
Sorry again?
But this is still a canonical transformation. P psi is still canonically conjugate to C. The Poisson bracket of P psi is vanished, right?
Yeah, it is a canonical transformation, exactly as before.
And second question was really, supposing I had not done this canonical transformation, then it is true that the vacuum is not in the domain of the Hamiltonian. But as you said, the unitary operator, being unitary, operate on everything, including the vacuum. So is there a fundamental problem with the old complex structure, the complex structure on the previous transparency, or is it for convenience that you are making this new canonical transformation?
Yes, I would say there is not a genuine problem for unitarity. The only thing is that if you want to, for instance, to study the evolution of the vacuum, then you have to find this evolution just by a limiting procedure, since it is not in the domain of the Hamiltonian. This may also be important if you want to define, as I said before, a matrix element, even more if you are thinking a kind of expansion series. Then, since the vacuum is not in the domain, this essentially it is not very convenient. I'm not saying that there is any problem at all with unitarity. So this is a point that I think is good, making clear the fact that the evolution has a unitary implementation does not mean that the generator has to be well defined on the vacuum.
Okay. And the last question is, if in fact the complex structure that would now result by taking combinations of your new coordinate with a C and P sub C, is this complex structure equivalent in the Hilbert-Schmidt sense, the one that you had on the previous transparency, with the canonical coordinates that you had with chi sub n and p sub chi?
So, once again, what happens here is that since the relation is given by a time-dependent canonical transformation, the Hamiltonian is different for the two systems, okay? So, in this sense, we are considering different dynamics. Even so, if the respective canonical transformation between the two possible descriptions were unitary, and if the vacuum were defined in, were in the domain of one of the Hamiltonians, and also on the generator of this relative canonical transformation, then it should be also in the domain of the new Hamiltonian. So this means that there is somewhere an operator in which we have problems with the vacuum. I hope that the answer has been clear enough.
Go on, we can come back.
Okay, thank you. So, what we have now is just a system with new field, psi, its momentum, and the Hamiltonian is just that of a free scalar field, and then we obtain a time-dependent part that corresponds to a potential and that can be interpreted as an effective time-dependent mass equal to 1 over 4 t squared. Notice also that this potential tends to zero for large time. So one would expect that asymptotically the dynamics would approach that of the free massless scalar field in two dimensions. The field equations are exactly those that correspond to a free field with zero, with time-dependent mass equal to 1 over 4 t squared, are defined in a flat Minkowski, a flat background in two dimensions with the topology of R plus times the circle. This is still one constraint in the system. See, not, which generates constant translations on the circle. I will call T alpha the translations with constant angle equal to alpha. So next slide. Now for the description of the system, again, one can expand the field and its momentum in Fourier series, and then form linear combinations that would essentially correspond to a free massless field. It would be the annihilation-like and creation-like variable for free massless field. I will comment later on the choice. Let me say that at least one would think that it does not introduce any explicit dependence on time. Now, with these variables to describe the phase space, what we do is to group them in vectors with four components. With the same weight number, m, which will be positive. I will treat a column vector, and the order in which the components are arranged is exactly the one that appears there, bm, b star minus m, b minus m, and b star m, which is not the order of conjugate pairs, because the let's say creation like variable conjugate to bm is b star m. But this way of ordering the components will be especially convenient for our expressions. So the first thing to notice is that the action of translations on the circle is diagonal in these coordinates, in this variable. Essentially, each of them gets just multiplied by a phase. The simplistic structure can be easily computed, and it has a block diagonal form with 4x4 blocks corresponding to each value of the weight number. Each of these blocks has only non-anti-diagonal non-vanishing elements that are described by a 2x2 matrix omega with those components minus I and I. Next slide, slide 14. Now, to describe the dynamics, I will try to be a little bit more general than just to consider the Gaudi model. We have seen that the Gaudi model, the dynamics is invariant and the translations on the circle. And it's also true that the dynamics is invariant under reversals of the angle theta. The action of this theta reversal transformation is just to change the sign of the wave vector. So for any system with these symmetries, it is easy to prove that the evolution, the dynamics, in terms of our coordinate B, will be given by a classical operator, capital U, that is diagonal in 4x4 blocks, with just some non-trivial components that are described by those coefficients alpha and beta, which are functions of the final and the initial time considered in our evolution. Of course, U is a Bogoliubov of transformation, and therefore one can show that the difference between the squares of the absolute values of alpha and beta must be equal to 1. Here we have the expression for a particular case of the Gaudi model in terms of the Hankel function. The particular expression is not important. They are put there just to see that we can do the calculations in detail explicitly. Okay. So we continue to slide 15. Now we introduce a complex structure, G0, that it is essentially the one that identifies the variables B as the annihilation-like variables and their complex conjugate as the creation-like variables. In this basis, of course, G0 is diagonal. We can just proceed to a standard Fock quantization of the system with this complex structure. I will call H0 the corresponding one-particle Hilbert space. So from the fact that G0 and the translations on the circle both are diagonal in our variables, it can easily be seen that they commute. This is that our choice of complex structure is invariant and that the group of translation on the circle. Remember that this group was the gauge group for our reduced Gaudi model. So this means that the Fock quantization that we have obtained provide some invariant unitary implementation of the gauge group, the group of translations on the surface. So the vacuum would be invariant, and the one particle Hilbert space will be true. Furthermore, one can check that the evolution of the system commutes with this constant translation. Okay. So this means that the physical Hilbert space, the space of the states that are left invariant by the translations on the circle, is stable under evolution. The evolution is well defined. Finally, one can also check that the antilinear part of our evolution operator U is Hilbert-Schmidt. The beta coefficients are square summable. I will not give more details about this because this will more surely explain in detail by Alejandro. The important thing is that essentially with our new field parametrization, we can obtain a fog quantization in which we can deal with the global constraint that is remaining in the system, and we obtain a unitary implementation of the dynamics. Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
This is Laurent Fredel. I have a question about so the vacuum state. So in these slides, you denote the vacuum state to be the state that annihilates BM. But I'm confused about one thing, is that BM, as you defined two slides before, is explicitly time dependent, which means that this vacuum state is zero, in fact, depends on the time. And the question of unitarity means whether the vacuum state defined at time t is orthogonal or not to the vacuum state defined at time t prime. So here it seems that you have gotten rid of the time dependence in the vacuum state that was the initial problem.
Okay, yes, as you say, essentially the complex structure is not invariant under evolution. This means that the vacuum is not left invariant by the evolution.
Well, if you go two slides before, let's say slide 13, I think, yeah. So where you have the definition of BN and BN dagger. So they are a combination of Xi N and P Xi. But Xi N and P Xi are time dependent. So it seems to me that the equation BN 0 equal to 0 is a time dependent equation. That is, what you call 0 is in fact 0 at time t. And
okay,
the question of unitarily, if you can unitarily implement these things, is also the question, you know, whether zero at time t and zero at time t prime are orthogonal or not.
Okay, Laura. There is a choice of Cauchy surface. That is exactly what you are saying when you are stating that Chi and its momentum depend on time. It depends on the choice of Cauchy surface that they are choosing for the construction. Then the second question is whether the vacuum, the ball vacuums of power on all, this is essentially what I am saying when I have or we have studied that the evolution is implemented unitarily. It is true that the vacuum is not invariant, but this does not mean that you cannot define the evolution in a unitary way and that the ball vacuum will be part of the Hilbert space. So this is what is happening here. It's not that you will obtain by evolution a state that is not part of your Hilbert state. And it's not that if you choose a different vacuum by choosing a different Cauchy surface, you will obtain a non-unitarily equivalent fog representation of the system.
So, okay. But can you comment then on this fact that you start from a theory where you can't implement it unitarily and then you do a canonical transformation and suddenly you can implement it unitarily? How is it possible in general?
Sorry, again?
what I'm asking, what is the mechanism at work that makes something which is not unitarily implementable becomes unitarily implementable after just a change of canonical transformation?
So here the subtlety is that the canonical transformation is time independent. So this means that part of the evolution has been taken as an explicit time dependence that has not to be generated by the Hamiltonian of the system. So in other words, you are taking a different Hamiltonian and a different evolution. You are considering as the fundamental field of the system another one with a different dynamic. That's why one of the dynamics is not unitarily implementable and the other is. It's somehow, let's say, strange. It is true that in the Gates fixed system, there is no obligation to choose one of the fields as the fundamental one. So what we are presenting is a different choice that solves this problem. There is more convenient that has, does not have problems with unitarity.
So,
is that okay?
If I may add, I think Guillermo gave a very complete answer, but kind of a less complete but a meta answer, so to say, is that the canonical transformation itself is not unitarily implemented. That is to say, the initial quantization that he had, the initial Fock space he had for quantization, initial representation of the field operator algebra that he had is unitarily inequivalent to the one he now has. So this is a genuinely new quantization. In finite dimensions, it is true that linear canonical transformations always lead to unitarily equivalent quantum theories. But in infinite dimension, this is not the case. And here we got a very explicit example, which also has the complications of time dependence, etc. But even without time dependence, the statement is that in infinite dimensions, canonical transformations can lead to inequivalent, unitarily inequivalent theories.
Okay. Just to get the last precision, what you call H0 there, so is it a time-dependent H0 or a time-independent? What you call the one particle Hilbert space?
Yeah, I mean, this, yes, one of those things depends on the language. So if you consider that it depends on the choice of Cauchy surface, then it is true. It depends on that choice.
No, I think I agree that is a choice of language, but I think it is convenient to think that you've got a fixed Hilbert space, H0 is fixed, and then the Hamiltonian is time dependent, and we are asking if the dynamics it generates is unitary.
Okay.
And I think that is a clearer, simpler way to think about it.
Thank you, Arthur.
Thank you.
So, so next slide, 15. So, I'm sure that Alejandro will explain many more details about the quantization of all these issues. What I am going to do now is to try to sketch a proof that at least when you fix the gauge, you deparametrize the system as it appears here, and then you choose exactly the field parametrization that we have introduced, then the Fock quantization that we have carried out, it is essentially unique. This means that any other Fock representation that has certain properties will be unitarily equivalent to ours. So the first thing is that we will only consider, of course, complex structures that are compatible with our complex structure, and then we will ask that they are invariant under translations on the circle. We restrict just to the case. We are giving an important role to translations, concept translation on the circle. It can be shown very easily that all such complex structures are related to ours, J0, just by a constant symplectic transformation. That is what I call here KJ. That has also a 4x4 block diagonal form, and that can be described just as two kinds of coefficients, kappa and lambda, that once again, since it is a symplectic transformation, satisfy that the difference between the square of their absolute values is equal to 1. In fact, in order to consider all possible complex structures, it is sufficient to restrict kappa to be positive. Then, one can show that, the usual thing to do now is to consider just exclusively those complex structures that will also lead to a unitary implementation of the evolution. The result, or one partial result, is that the evolution is unitary implementable with respect to this new complex structure if and only if we have that the new evolution induced by the symplectic transformation KJ acting on U, this thing that I have called there UJ, is unitarily implementable with respect to G naught, the original complex structure. So essentially what we have to consider now is just symplectic transformation KJ such that they lead also to unitary implementable evolutions UJ. It is easy from the expression of U and of KJ to obtain the expression for UJ that has exactly the same block structure as before, with coefficients alpha J and beta J. There are linear combinations of the original one, alpha and beta, and with the coefficients that depend on kappa and lambda. Particularly, you have there the expression for beta J, which this calligraphic I is the imaginary part. So before continuing, what we would like to prove is that if the new evolution UJ is unitarily implementable, then our complex structure J is in fact equivalent to G naught. Given the form of G, what we have to prove then is that the symplectic transformation KJ is unitary, or what is the same, that its antilinear part is Hilbert-Schmidt. So we have to prove that the sequence of the square absolute values of lambda is summable. Okay, next slide. From the expression of beta, one can obtain the inequality that appears there, and that is valid for any positive number, A, and I have already summed over the wave numbers M up to a certain integer, capital N, that is generic. So, the situation is as follows. I am already assuming that the evolution U is unitary implementable with respect to G naught, so that the beta coefficients are square summable. I am assuming that the evolution is unitary implementable with respect to J, the new complex structure, so that the coefficients beta J are square summable. So essentially, the right-hand side part of our inequality is a sequence that converges, the sum converges. On the left-hand side, we have the coefficients lambda, the square of their absolute value. If the coefficients that are multiplying there, them had an infimum for values of n that were strictly positive, then we will get an upper bound for the partial sums of lambda squared. And since these partial sums form an increasing sequence, then we will know that the sum, the infinite sum, is finite, converged. But the general situation is that these coefficients will, in general, have no positive increment. They can even change time. So let me consider just, let's say, for inspiration, the free matchless case. In that case, the coefficients alpha are just a phase, and the coefficients beta are equal to zero. So the thing that appears in this round bracket is just a cosine. With the periodicity, there is a submultiple of pi. It is true that in this case, you don't have a positive, a strictly positive infinite, but if you average over the difference of the times T1 and T0, you get positive quantities. So the idea is just to make exactly the same here and average over the difference. To be sure that this average is well-defined and gives something bounded on the right-hand side of our inequality, then we have also to assume that the coefficients alpha and beta are measurable functions of this difference of time. If this happens, the same is true for beta and beta j. And then one can use a theorem that is called Egoroff theorem to prove that given any positive quantity delta, there always exists a subset in zero pi that we'll call E delta with a measure greater, a Lebesgue measure greater than P minus delta, such that the average of the right hand side of our inequality is bounded by a positive number, I delta, for any value of the integer n. So it's a uniform bound. Next slide, 18. So now it suffices to assume that there exists a quantity delta in zero greater than zero and smaller than pi, such that for all subsets in zero pi with measure greater than p minus delta, the average of 1 minus the square of the real part of alpha is bounded from below by a positive quantity that is called here delta e that may depend on the particular set that one is considered, but it does not depend on the wave number m. It's a uniform bound for m. This assumption is true for the free matchless case. I can show that the same thing happens for the Godin model, essentially because its dynamics tends asymptotically to that of the free matchless case. Then, now it's very easy to show that from the inequality that we had, one can obtain an upper bound for the partial sums of the square absolute values of lambda, so that the infinite sum of these square coefficients converges, and therefore this means that the synthetic transformation Kj can be implemented unitarily. So essentially what this means is that all those complex structures are equivalent, lead to a unitary equivalent POC representations to that POC representation that we have obtained with the complexity schema. So let me state again the result. The result is that all compatible complex structures that are invariant under translations on the surface and that provide a unitary implementation of the time evolution lead to FOC representations that are unitarily equivalent. In this sense, our FOC quantization is unique. Okay, next slide.
Guillermo, can I just ask one question here?
Yes, sure.
So the last uniqueness thing was a bit technical, so let me just try to understand this. So basically you are saying, you start by assuming that you have got two complex structures, J and J naught, and you first assume that they actually both commute or are invariant under the group of under the rigid group of translations along the circle S1, because that is motivated by your leftover constraint that you had imposed. And then that says that the two complex structures are related by a matrix which you call K. And this matrix K is made up of kappas and lambdas. And then in the next couple of pages, you made arguments to say that if, in fact, dynamics is unitarily implemented, both with respect to J naught and with respect to J, then lambdas satisfy a certain bound, which was on page 18, which is the main equation on page 18 right now. And then you want to conclude that therefore the symplectic transformation K sub J was such that in fact the two Fock spaces that you would get from J and J naught are unitarily equivalent. If this is correct, my question is really about, we spent all this time worrying about lambda sub m, but isn't there any condition on kappa sub m, which also features in the expression of K?
I'm not sure that I understood your question in the following sense. The important thing is that K is unitary with respect to the quantization that we have presented here, then the two considered complex structures will be equivalent. And for that, what is relevant is the antilinear part, is exactly a lambda. Kappa appears in all our expressions, but we are using that at least its absolute value is given by that of lambda, because they are constrained by the fact that it is a symplectic transformation, so that K, the absolute value of kappa squared minus the absolute value of lambda squared is equal to 1. With that, it is sufficient to prove that the two complex structures are equivalent.
Good. So it is sufficient to just focus on lambda, and then you can show that the two complex structures are equivalent. I just wanted to clarify it for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, you make a very good summary of the rationale. Yes.
Okay, let's go.
So, slide 19. So, some remarks essentially about the proof. The first thing is that the proof is more general than just for the Goldie model with the topology of the three totals, and that's why I have somehow tried to make it general, although it is in this sense more abstract, as I have presented it. It can be applied to other field dynamics, that essentially what is important is that in a certain sense they approach the free massless dynamic. For instance, it can be applied to any of those cases in which the dynamics coincides with that of the free massless case in the entire future of a Cauchy surface. So it can be applied just to show the uniqueness of the thought representation also in this system. Now, another thing is that, well, in a certain sense, the proof that we have presented seems to be the one that requires weaker condition on the Fock quantization, the Fock representation that is studied. One could also prove uniqueness by replacing the requirement of unitary implementation of the dynamic by demanding that the Fock vacuum belongs to the domain of the Hamiltonian. We know that if we have a unitary equivalent Fock quantization, since the vacuum is in the domain of the Hamiltonian for the original complex structure J naught, then the new vacuum will be also in the domain of the Hamiltonian with the equivalent choice of complex structure. But it could happen that the vacuum, if this, the alternative vacuum is in the domain of the Hamiltonian, for a complex structure that leads to a non-equivalent unitary, POC quantization of the system. However, it is possible to show that this is not the case for the Gaudi model when one demands, in addition, that the complex structure is invariant under constant translation of the sum. So this condition is sufficient also to warrant the unity of the quantization. Now, in our proof, the compactness of the topology seems to play an important role, and in particular, the fact that translations on the circle, the gauge group, come from the fact that we have not completely fixed the gauge. There is something that, in general, for non-compact topology, you can do. So it seems that it is important to have the compact topology, at least for our argument. In contrast, the role of the spatial dimension seems to be less relevant. It would be interesting to study whether one can generalize the results to higher dimensions. Now, another question is just our choice of complex structure genomes. One could instead be tempted to choose as the natural complex structure the one that corresponds to the instantaneous value of the mass at the time t naught corresponded to the Cauchy surface that we have chosen. However, it is true that for compact topology, g naught and this complex structure corresponding to this mass are in fact equivalent. They lead to unitary equivalent POC representations. And once again, in this case, the compactness of the topology is important. Even more, in a certain sense, the choice of this alternate complex structure is not more natural than G naught because of the fact that one can prove, one can calculate that evolution leads this complex structure with this instantaneous value of the max, they lead to other complex structures that do not coincide with those that are associated to the bulk mass. If this had been the case, it would have been more natural to adopt this other complex structure in the sense that one would have incorporated the time-dependent mass of the system. But since it is not possible, and it would depend completely on this choice of constant essential T naught, then, essentially it is completely equivalent in our case, and the calculation seems to be simple if one adopts G naught as the complex structure. Okay, next slide. So here are some remarks that concern works by other people. The first one refers to a recent work by Torrey, in which he shows that in the Schrödinger functional representation that corresponds to the standard field description of the Gaudi model, one can prove that the Gaussian measures that one obtains at different times are mutually singular. This means that if one chooses two different times, then one can find a set, let's say A, such that it has zero measure with one of the measures, and its complement has zero measure with the other considered measure. This pathology, however, can be seen to be removed if this appears when one adopts the field parametrization that we have introduced. Now, another thing is that this new field parametrization can be extended to other models, and in particular, for instance, can be considered for the case of the Gaudi model with general polarization, not just with linear polarization, as is the case that we have considered in the talk. In that case, one can see that one can just reformulate the system as being described by two fields. One of them propagates in a two-dimensional flat background and has a time-dependent mass, just like the one that we have studied. And the second field is coupled to this first one by a coupling that depends on time. The same kind of field parametrization or the scaling of the fundamental field can also be introduced for cylindrical gravity, right? In particular in the case of Einstein-Rosen waves. This recent work by Cho and Bharadarajan, in which they showed that there exists certain unitary problems in parametric field theory for this kind of cylindrical waves, the Einstein-Rosen waves, affecting the radial diffeomorphism. One can prove that an scaling of the fundamental field by a square root of R cures those problems. This is different to having proof that there is absolutely no problem with unitarity, but at least the problems that have been detected by Cho and Bharadarajan can be solved. I want also to comment that in this case of cylindrical gravity, the commented scaling was already considered in 2000 by Niedermayer to define the fundamental field not just on a flat three-dimensional background, but on anti-Sitting two dimensions. And in fact, he also made some comments about the unitarity of the quantization. Okay, the final slide. So, just to conclude, what we have done is introduce a new field parametrization for the golden metric, and we have completed it into a 10-dependent canonical transformation in such a way that we have the distributed the 10 dependence of the system into an explicit part and an implicit part, and such that the later one is unitary implementable in quantum theory. So, as I have been saying along the talk, there is still certain freedom in our choices. There is some freedom in the choice of the parametrization, that is, in the 10 gauge. But nonetheless, our 10 gauge is at least the most natural one for the system. One could also try to analyze, for instance, the choice of an internal time given by the zero mode of the scalar field, of the fundamental field size. And this could be interesting for, for cosmology or, or in other, if one wants to study, for instance, the initial singularity. Another choice refers to the field parametrization of the system. Let me say that it's not difficult, and we will probably do it, it's not difficult to consider other field parametrization that are obtained by canonical transformations that are linear on phase space and time dependent. One can see what are the conditions that assure that the quantization is essentially unique. In our case, once these two choices have been made, the parametrization and field parametrization, it is true that if one demands a unitary implementation of the dynamic and invariance under translation of the circle, then the Fock representation is unique up to a unitary transformation. Now, essentially related to Laurent's comment, it is true that the Fock vacuum is not left invariant by the evolution. From the standard point in quantum field theory, this means that there is particle production in the system, although one can show that it attenuates for asymptotically large time. But this interpretation of particle production relies on a fiducial background that has no physical reality. From the point of view of gravity in four dimensions, from the point of view of the metric in 3 plus 1 dimension, this background is completely auxiliary, it has no physical meaning. So the particle has no genuinely physical interpretation. The final thing that I wanted to say is that it would be very interesting to construct geometric operators, in particular, to describe the metric. Also, to introduce a proper time in quantum theory and study in that the behavior of the singularity to see what happens quantum mechanically. In this way, one would really get an intuition in the physics of the system, and this will be also be very nice to compare the results with other possible approaches to the quantization, like, for instance, with loop methods. Okay, I think this is all I wanted to say. No questions?
Ore, are you still there?
Yes.
Yes, I am.
Okay, so if you have no questions, let's thank Guillermo again.